accession number 233706.
Given what you've been telling me, there is certain, well, quite a lot of uncertainty going on, particularly in your position below decks, as to what's going on. You're only really sort of guessing at what's happened.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
How are you sort of feeling in this particular instance where you realise that, you know, things are looking pretty grim?
Well, the order we got our orders via a counter which was operated from above us. Orders came down, would come down for various orders would come down for various types of shells, armour piercing, semi-armour piercing, high angle, or, you know, that sort of thing. They were numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. If the pointer came down and went down to 5, you knew that you had to put out high angle shells, or if it went up and down 2 or 3 times. There were various explanations of what happened. Well, this thing operated, and we looked on the board to see what it was, and the order was, or the explanation was, that the lobby above is flooding, evacuate. So we still didn't know we had to abandon ship, and of course the shell handling room is only quite a tiny place, and it's pretty confined, and as you can imagine, being in there with all that activity going on, and perspiration just drops off you, and because then we had to pick up what clothes you'd taken off and start and go up. So we went up the ladder, unclipped the dogs on the hatch, pushed the hatch up, and of course then, as you're supposed to do when you're all out of there, put the hatch back down, close the dogs, and then go up the next deck and do the same thing, and came out up onto the what was known as the wardroom flat, and that was one down below the upper deck, and there was a stoker running around there with a big torch. He was one of when there's any problems there, the people that if there's a one of the walls start to collapse, they hold it up with shores and that sort of thing. And he had said, don't you know? it's abandoned ship. Oh, geez. So it's about time to get out of here. So we had to go up another deck to get onto the upper deck. I think by this time we'd had the third torpedo. And the rest of our group had gone up, and I got up. I was the last one up there, and got up through the hatch onto the upper deck, and just then the fourth torpedo came in and went bang, and that was directly underneath us and would have gone in where we'd come out of. And this thing, of course, the whole deck sort of just lifted, or everything lifted. And I can remember going up in the air and spinning around and coming down an awful thump on the deck, and slid over towards the scuppers because she was heeling a bit onto the port side. and slid down underneath the guardrail and up against the degaussing gear that went around the upper deck, and sort of lay there for a moment, a bit stunned, and then realised, geez, I've got to get out of this. So I got up and shot through around to the starboard side of the ship, because I knew we had to get out of it. And if you were over on the port side, although you were close to the water, you also just as likely get sucked down. Now, I wasn't going to go over right up because the screws were still turning. So I went up to what is known as the waist of the ship, where the torpedoes were fired from. And we got up there, and the torpedo tubes, or where they sat, they was all aimed outward, and there were none left in there. They'd all gone. And I distinctly remember there was only a small space in which I could have a free go at getting over the side. And this bloke was standing there, and I said to him, well, are you or aren't you? Because I am. And he stepped to one side, and I went over. And of course, the when you looked around, of course, there were still shells flying everywhere and lights, searchlights going.
The ship was encircled now, but basically just people taking pot shots at it.
Oh, that's right. And it was going down. You could see that. And of course, the thing was, get away from it. You know,
What sort of equipment did you have with you? Was it just you and a life jacket, or
just me?
Not even a life jacket.
When that last torpedo went off, of course, I didn't have a life jacket on, because down below in the shell handling room, it was nothing but a nuisance, and of course would hamper you terribly, because when you put the shells into this hoist, there was a very strict routine to go through. Because it was all hydraulic, you had to make sure that there was only the shell in there, and when you put the shell in, you held it, picked it up and held it with your right hand on the nose cone, and the shell lay across your left arm, and with your right hand you pushed the shell into the base of the shell into the hoist, and then you never used your right hand to put the shell in, you used your left arm, so that your arm went across the opening, and under no circumstances could you get your hand, your foot, or your arm or anything caught. So using with a life jacket on, it was a hindrance. So
what was the feeling then to be going over the side without a life jacket?
Oh, I could swim. No, I wasn't too worried. And as a matter of fact, the life jacket was the last thing I was worried about at that time, because I knew we weren't far from land, because when we got up on deck, of course, you have a quick shifty around to see whether where was the best place to go to, or to go have a go at getting to. And there was going to be a certain amount of damage and wreckage and so forth in the water. And also, while we were in Tanjung Priok, there were a whole bundle of merchant navy life rafts that the old man had seen and had put on board ship. And of course, they were just tied down with enough just to keep them from being junk floating around the place. So of course a couple of the first sailors were up there, took out their knives, just cut them loose, and these things went overboard, and of course they were They take plenty of lives, those things. But, I got into the water, wasn't too worried about not having anything, and swam over to one of the groups, and they were on a, they had one of the big spars that we had on board, with a boom that you use for when you're in harbour. It projects out from the side of the ship, and you hook up the boats to it just so they've got something to tie on to. And it was quite a long length of timber, and there were quite a few people hanging on to it. I hitched onto that for a ride for a while, but as far as I could see, it wasn't going to get us too far. But then suddenly I realised that there was a lot of movement in the water, and we were being pushed and by this this current. Also on board, there had been two garden seats, and they were just ordinary seats, about 6 foot long, and just in a classic chair shape. And one of these things went floating past, and my tiny mind said, "That's not a bad idea." So I swam over to it and grabbed hold of it, and found that by balancing on it, but I was getting quite a good ride on the current. I had a couple of blokes come with me for a while, but then they swam off to go somewhere else or to try something else. But I found that was a very good support on it. I hung on to that all night, so it was quite a good thing.
I understand that once you're in the water, from a couple of people I've spoken to, that there is a sort of relief. You're off the ship, you're away from danger. Was that something you experienced?
Oh yes, yeah. The first reaction I had was absolute disbelief and shock, if you like, that suddenly there was my home going down, and everything that I owned was going down with it. Because when I'd been coming up on deck with gear in my hand, such as your belt that has all your money in it and all that sort of thing, of course that all went as well as my life jacket. So everything that I had gone.
What about your confidence? The fact that you had this confidence and assumed that your ship would never be hit or you would never go down, and here it is happening.
Oh yes, yeah. I mean, that was a real confident shaker. But all right, I've got other problems at the moment. And what about that? But the absolute disbelief that your ship had been sunk. Just like that, and it seemed to happen too easily, or you know, too quickly. We'd been through one lot and come out of that absolutely unscathed, and then to have this thing happen just like that and so quickly. It was only a bit over an hour's operation and the whole thing, and it was an absolute shaker of your confidence for that to have happened.
So here you are, floating on a seat.
Yeah, that's right.
Middle of the Sunda Strait. Where were you heading?
Well, I could see some land further down, and we were heading in that sort of direction, and I thought, well, here I am. Sort of just hang on, in a couple of minutes you're going to be scratching sand. But of course the problem is that you've got to be so lucky to be able to, or either that or a very powerful swimmer, to break through that current that goes through there, because we found out afterwards it's about a 5 to 7 knot current. Well, you know, anybody who swim 5 to 7 knots through a current like that, it's got to be a pretty powerful swimmer. And there were some very good swimmers on board, people who were more state champions and people of that ilk, and they never even got out of it. So here's silly old me floating around on a seat, and you come through it. But I was prepared to start and put my feet down and feel for the bottom. But in the meantime, suddenly the island had gone. You were spun off around it with the force of the current, because the current divides up the island and just flipped around. So there wasn't that wasn't very hopeful at all. But I just stayed with the seat until morning came, and of course that wasn't such a bright prospect either. But
what did you see as light?
Oil was everywhere, because the number of ships that had been sunk the surface of the water was just thick with oil, and it was in your throat, it was in your eyes, it was in your ears, it was up your nose, it was everywhere. And of course, as the sun came out, it started to burn, and that wasn't very nice at all. And of course, in February up there, you've still got quite a bit of heat in the sun, and that wasn't good, and that was quite a problem. As light came aboard, I suddenly found that I was alone on this seat, except for a bloody great crab. He was an enormous sod. I soon got rid of him. I couldn't eat him, of course, but I wasn't that hungry, but well, not at that time. But I didn't fancy sharing it with him, so I wiped him off and put him back in his element. But then, of course, as I say, the heat and the oil, that was the nasty bit. And there was no relief from it. You couldn't do anything. If you went under the water, it was salt. And on top, it was oil. So there wasn't much option, really. Just battle on as much as you could. Fortunately, I had a fairly strong grip on life, and I wasn't going to give up on the thing. But
was there anyone around that you could see at all?
Yes, you could see odd people at a distance and that sort of thing. But then I spotted a ship standing still, and obviously there were people being taken on board, so that was where I headed, because I couldn't see much future in trying to swim past some of these islands or try and break this current or that sort of thing. And by that time, not having too many clothes left, it was imperative that I try and get somewhere. So I was about 50 yards away from this damn thing, and I thought, well, I can swim that bit. And I slightly overestimated the amount of strength that I had left. By the time I got there, I was really glad to have got there. But at the bottom of the ladder up to this destroyer was what we call the copper punt. It was a two pontoons, and they were about 3 feet apart, and there was a device that was used on board ship to paint right down at the waterline. It was just these two pontoons with a little area in the middle, about 4 feet square. Somebody had managed to get this thing out or picked it up in the water or something, and had been with it all night, of course, and there it was at the bottom of the ladder. And it had a hat in it, and I didn't have enough bloody sense to pick the hat up and take with me. But when we got up on, climbed up the top of the ladder to get up on the deck, and the deck, of course, was bloody red hot, and I had no shoes on or no boots on, and got up there and probably burned the soles of your feet. Of course, there was nowhere to go. And the chap sailors did a very good job. As we got to the top, each person, as he came up, was given two little bags of biscuits. They're little sweet biscuits. They're quite sugary things. They use them quite a lot. And, of course, they made very convenient things to stand on the bloody hot deck. That, and they gave you a G-string. Because your clothes were falling off you, sort of thing. But that was sort of about the end of that part of the episode. It was.
What did it feel like then to be on board ship and a prisoner of war now of the Japanese?
Yeah, well, it didn't feel very bright, but at least there was some relief to the. But there was some relief to the fact that. At least you'd got out of the water, and whatever else came from there on, that was something that you were having to take a punt on, guess at, or see what was going to come.
How many other blokes were on board at that time?
There would have been, I guess there would have been 20 or 30 blokes anyway. They were all up on the upper deck, and they took us over to. One of the transports, as I remember, it was the Somdong Maru, I think it was the name of it, and we were put on board this transport. Well, transport for Australian troops going overseas, of course, was always fairly crowded, but nothing like these blokes. So they just had these spaces on the deck, and that was it. You just made do with what was there. All I had was just to draw a map. It was down there, and that was your area. But that was the beginning of the captivity part of it, which wasn't.
At this point, how you mentioned that the sailors were actually quite helpful, quite good to you.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
I get the impression that the sailors have a sort of close contact with one another, given the fact that they're sailors. Would I be right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the law of the sea is that you, L-O-R-E of the sea, is that you don't abandon anybody at sea, or if they ask for help, you give them help. And that was very true, because later on, we came in contact with a few Japanese sailors, and they were always very good to us. Not relatively good to us in comparison to what others were to us. But that was, it was very evident. And it held quite true.
Well, tell us what was to happen next.
Well, we didn't know what was to happen next, but we were in this transport, and we were given given a little bit of food, a bit of rice. That's all you were given. Perhaps one of the things that stood out, we had a petty officer on board, quite a character. Back when I'm a Slim Hedrick, very tall, gangly black, bit of a grizzler. He'd been on the ship part of us since he was commissioned. Funny bloke in his own way. But whenever he went to action stations, he always used to get down to the sick bay and get a couple of French letters. And in those French letters, he would put a packet of tobacco in one and a box of matches and cigarette papers in the other, tie them up and put them in his overall. Anyway, when we got on board this Somme Longue Maru, everybody was, because most of us smoked in those days, and all busting an eyeball for a smoke, and old Slim pulled out his packet of caps and tobacco and these papers, and he stood up and he said, "Righto, all you bastards who laughed at me because I put these things in the condoms," he said, "you can laugh now." He said, "I'm bloody laughing too." He said, "I'm going to have a smoke, but bugger you." But that was just a bit of an episode. But
presumably he did actually share out his tobacco.
Oh, yes, yeah. But also there was the evenings. In one of the evenings we're on board there, it was almost as though it had been set up by a Hollywood sort of entertainment person. It was just late dusk. The evening had come down, and it was just so quiet, and it was dark enough so that you couldn't see across the other side of the ship, but you could hear this murmur of people talking. And then this bloke started to sing, and he sang Begin the Beginning, and of course at that time it was pretty well a brand new thing. He had a very good voice, and he sang this thing and you could have heard a pin drop, and not one of the Japs said a word, nobody said anything. Like to sang this thing, sir, and it was just so memorable as far as I was concerned, because it was just absolute Hollywood magic that had been transported there. It was just so remarkable. But they were only magic moments that came very few and far between. But what was to happen, we had no idea. Not at that time.
The words of Begin the Begin, some of them, even the palm trees seem to be swaying.
Oh, that's right, yeah. It was, when you know the words or hear the words, and it's a very expressive song, of course, it rises and lows. And this bloke had a very good voice and a very good range of this.
Given the fact that you weren't really anywhere near palm trees or any exotic sort of comfortable place, how did it make you feel to hear this chap's...
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, it was wonderful. It was... It perhaps took your mind away a little bit from what could have been, what is going to be. You didn't know, but it was very good entertainment at the time. As I say, the setting was just so magic, but there we were.